Radio's KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego County, and globally at kpfk.org.
Well, good afternoon. Good afternoon, KPFK family members and listeners. This is Jim Lafferty along with Maria Hall. We're co-hosts here of the Lawyers Guild show every week. And Maria, how are you this afternoon? I almost didn't get here. The traffic was so crazy. I'm still sort of out of breath, but how are you doing?
Oh, well, catch your breath, please. I'm doing just fine. Thanks.
Okay, good. I know we have a full show. Let's get right to it. What's our first segment? Tell us about the whole day.
Okay, sure. We've got a great show lined up once again. In our first half hour, in honor of Women's History Month, we're going to be discussing the status of women in the workforce. Then at 3:30, we'll be joined by legal scholar Marjorie Cohen about her latest article called Israel Didn't Even Attempt to Defend the Legality of Its Occupation to the World Court. So that'll be at the half hour.
Yep.
So, but in the meantime, let's go ahead and launch right in. Are you ready?
Yes, yes.
All right. Okay. Well, as I said, in honor of Women's History Month, we're featuring segments here on the Lawyers Guild show about the status of women and girls in society in the here and now. In other words, not only where we've been, but where we are today and what we can and should be doing right now to ensure a better future for ourselves and our loved ones. So this half hour, and continuing into next week, we'll be talking about women and equity, or lack thereof, in labor and employment. Yes, we have laws on the books that prohibit sexual harassment and discrimination at work. Yes, we have laws that promise equal pay for equal work. Yes, we have laws that protect women's jobs when they're pregnant. And yes, we have hundreds of laws requiring humane working conditions, including those requiring a minimum wage, meal and rest breaks, and overtime. But what's it really like out there in the real world for women who are struggling to earn a living? Are employers responding to the call to make sure women are safe at work and treated and paid fairly? And if not, how hard is it for women to exercise their rights and get legal help if and when they need it? It's a big topic, but we have a wonderful guest here with us to talk about it, attorney Beth Graves Meyerhoff. Beth is with Public Counsel's Project for Women and Girls. And for listeners who may not know about Public Counsel, it's the largest pro bono law firm in the nation located right here in Los Angeles. Beth joined Public Counsel in 2022, and she represents clients in the California Civil Rights Department and Labor Commissioner proceedings, as well as Title IX sexual violence cases. Beth began her career at Betzedek Legal Services and spent several years representing clients in unlawful detainers, consumer fraud, and public benefits. She later worked for the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, aka the EEOC, in employment discrimination cases. Beth Graves Meyerhoff, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Sure. So to start us off, I know Public Counsel has a whole program area devoted to advancing women and girls' rights. Can you talk about this program in broad strokes, how it came about, and what are some of its priorities and goals?
Absolutely. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about our Audrey Ermes Women and Girls' Rights Project. We are one of 8 projects at Public Counsel, and we were founded in 2017 with a generous grant and continued support from Audrey Ermes. And we also have a grant from the California Commission on the Status of Women. So we're a small project with 3 staff attorneys, 1 directing attorney, and a project assistant. Our goal is to seek to advance the rights of cis and transgender women, girls, and gender expansive individuals in the workplace and higher education. So we offer a combination of direct legal services, policy advocacy, impact litigation, and community education. We focus on two primary areas, advocating for gender equity and workplace justice and supporting complainants in Title IX cases. So our direct services work includes free counsel and advice, advocacy and intervention with employers and schools, representation and administrative processes, and litigation. We also are advocating for laws and policies that advance social, racial, and gender justice and support working families. And then we also provide education and outreach to empower workers and students with information about their rights, which includes community Know Your Rights education. As far as future priorities, we are engaging in a community needs assessment survey of LA County residents. And our goal is to ensure that the legal needs of the community that we serve are being met. So we are asking people to identify their legal needs and barriers to accessing those legal services.
Well, Beth Meyerhoff, Jim Lafferty here. I wonder, in broad strokes, again, what are some of the factual barriers that most women and girls face in their quest to achieve that equity and equal opportunity, equal pay that they're entitled to at work? What factually are the ways in which that is often a hurdle for them or a denial of those rights?
Well, unfortunately, women do continue to face barriers in the workplace, and these can include sexual harassment, discrimination, wage theft, violence, and other barriers. And our lower wage workers, women of color, and transgender women are particularly affected. So the fact that there are laws prohibiting workplace violations, there are still violations that occur. Some of the barriers that we see are that many clients cannot easily find an attorney to represent them, for they may potentially have a small claim recovery, or sometimes the defendant may not have many resources or be hard to locate. Accessing justice can be time-consuming, requiring people to take time off from work or be away from families, which is particularly challenging for low-wage workers who cannot afford to miss work. Many of our clients file complaints with administrative agencies, and they have a very long backlog. Cases can sometimes take years to investigate. Our clients come from many different countries and speak many different languages. So mm-hmm. not only are they unfamiliar with our legal system, they may experience language barriers. So we are trying to help them overcome these barriers by offering our intakes in Spanish as well as a language line for the languages we don't speak, and trying to do our education and outreach programs in English, Spanish, and other languages. Mm-hmm. And I think probably one of the biggest challenges is that many of our clients require trauma-informed approach and support. So they often present not only with the trauma that brought them to our office, but prior experiences as well. So we try to offer a holistic, client-centered approach. We try to provide support for clients so that they are able to pursue their legal claims and issues. And this support can be critical for clients who might otherwise perceive this lack of support as a barrier to asserting their rights.
Mm-hmm.
So we work to help women overcome these barriers. We want workers to understand that they are not alone. Sexual harassment is a problem faced by many workers. A 2019 study found that nearly 38% of women and 17% of men have reported sexual harassment at work. So the majority of harassment does go unreported. Another study shows that over 85% of people who experience sexual harassment never filed a formal charge, and 70% never even complained internally. So we try to, in our outreach, we try to teach strategies such as speaking up if it's safe to do so, or speaking to someone a worker trusts about what they're experiencing so that they have support. We encourage them to get help from a worker organization or a legal aid group. To help them understand their rights, suggest ways to address the problems, and help them decide whether to speak to their employer and what to say. And sometimes people don't know if the conduct they're experiencing is illegal. So we encourage people to trust their instincts. Illegal sexual harassment can be as simple as repeated touching of the waist or back. If the person has expressed that the touching makes them uncomfortable and the person continues to do it. And sexual harassment can also be verbal, such as comments about an employee's body or clothing or making jokes in front of the employee. And it could also be nonverbal, such as staring or giving an employee unwanted gifts. So we try to help people that contact us understand what they're experiencing and how it affects their workplace.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and there's so many threads there that I would love to follow up on, but I'm going to stick to a few points. I know that listeners, everyone can relate to this because everyone's been in that position, unless you were born a boss, where somebody else has this power over you, including landlords, just like landlords and tenants. Mm-hmm. So the law provides all of these rights on paper, but okay, a lot of good that's going to do you if you really need to get your paycheck. And I wanted to follow up a little bit about what you said about some of the special challenges by certain groups. You mentioned immigrants. Los Angeles has, 200 or 300 languages spoken here, and maybe women of color and single moms, for example, and dealing with childcare. And then also transgender women. You mentioned that public counsel provides services for both cisgender and transgender women. Can you talk about, pinpoint a couple of those special groups and maybe just tell listeners about your experiences about, what kinds of legal issues come up at work for some of these groups?
Our undocumented worker clients do face additional fears and challenges. Everybody should be able to work in a safe environment and be free from violations of their workplace rights. But undocumented workers can be afraid to report violations due to fear of removal or threats of immigration related retaliation. Employers know that and exploit that. Yet labor and employment agencies do need that worker testimony and evidence in order to hold employers accountable. So there's a program called Deferred Action in which undocumented workers who report workplace rights violations to government agencies may qualify for a temporary legal immigration benefit and a work permit for up to 2 years. So we do advise workers to seek an immigration consultation first to learn the particular risks in their case, but filing an employment claim or reporting workplace crimes could make a worker eligible for immigration relief, and the worker is then available to provide testimony and help hold employers accountable for these workplace violations. Single mothers and caregivers who are the sole provider for their families are particularly vulnerable because they don't want to risk losing their jobs and their benefits, which could significantly impact their families. So it's illegal to retaliate against a worker for reporting discrimination or harassment, but even though it is illegal, some employers still retaliate against workers who assert their workplace rights by firing them. So a person who's responsible for a family, rent, and children might not want to risk losing their source of income after reporting a workplace violation. And transgender workers also face additional challenges, such as coworkers or supervisors not using preferred pronouns, discrimination in healthcare benefits, and harassment and discrimination based on their gender identity, or gender expression. Many of our clients, such as our women of color, not only face particular challenges, they may experience intersectionality. And so that's the multiple ways that discrimination overlap and intersect.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk, Beth, about access now to justice. I really appreciate the way you've described what those issues are, how they impact different categories or groups of women in different ways and so forth. But in terms of the access itself, if a woman's rights are being violated at the workplace, what are her options? Is justice, only there for those who have a high profile case? Are those the only ones that tend to get tended to? What about the cost of hiring a lawyer? Help us understand this question of access to justice and the role it plays, if you will, in protecting the rights of women who have been discriminated against in various ways at work.
So first, there is help for all the rest of us. The case does not have to be high profile. Women and girls at work should know that there are laws to protect them. There's the California Fair Employment and Housing Act, which protects workers against discrimination and retaliation. And one of the protected characteristics includes sex, which includes the pregnancy and childbirth and breastfeeding. And California's anti-harassment law applies to all workplaces, no matter how many employees. So no one should suffer harassment at work. So we've talked about the option of workers speaking up and reporting to their employers. So once an employee makes a report of harassment, the employer must take reasonable steps to investigate. But sometimes employers don't investigate or the harassment continues. So another option is to file an administrative complaint. People do not need to hire a lawyer to file a complaint. In California, employees can file a complaint for discrimination or harassment under state law with the California Civil Rights Department. And workers can also file with the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, otherwise known as the EEOC, to protect their rights under federal law. And I just want to mention that it's important to know that both discrimination and harassment claims have deadlines by which you need to file your complaint. So if you want to file with the EEOC, you must file within 300 days of the incident when your rights were violated. And if you file with the Civil Rights Department, you have up to 3 years from the date when your rights were violated. So if you're thinking about bringing a claim, don't wait too long. So if the EEOC and Civil Rights Department investigates your claim, decides not to bring a lawsuit, then the agency issues what's called a right to sue letter. So once an employee has a right to sue letter, another option is that women can file a lawsuit in federal or state court. Our office and other legal aides may be able to help with litigating workplace claims without charge, or private attorneys may also be able to take a case.
Yes, and so that we can put kind of a human face on this, I imagine you've represented hundreds of workers in your career. Can you talk about a few examples of the individual struggles that you've seen and hopefully some happy success stories and sort of what people can expect if they do go through the process? You know, what are the potential outcomes?
Sure. Well, one case our project litigated was on behalf of a single mother who was desperate for income to support her son as he approached college age. She worked as a delivery driver for two busy flower shops run by the employer. So when the pandemic began, all of the other drivers quit, and our client's son began to work after school and on weekends helping her make deliveries so the shops would not fall behind. So both of them worked for 7 days a week for several months, covering all the shop's orders and until the employer terminated their employment. So throughout their employment, our clients were not paid all the wages they were owed, were not paid for overtime, and were not allowed to take breaks. So after nearly 3 years of litigation, we were able to negotiate a favorable settlement that compensated them for their wage theft and the other workplace violations they experienced. So this was a life-changing outcome for our clients.
Yes.
Another case, in addition to our workplace justice work, we also support students who report sexual harassment and assault at their schools. Some more statistics: at the undergraduate level, almost 1 in 4 undergraduates experience sexual assault or misconduct. So our clients file what's known as Title IX complaints. And Title IX is a federal civil rights law that ensures no person is subject to discrimination under education program or activity. So it's often thought of in the context of athletics as equity in sports, but it also includes equitable access to educational programs or activities. So Title IX applies to all students, regardless of gender identity. And once students report sexual violence or harassment, they should receive information about what happens after a report's made, including how the investigation is going to go and what interim measures are available. So one of our student clients experienced an increasingly hostile environment during her freshman year from a former friend, which culminated in a sexual assault. She reported the harassment and assault to her Title IX office, and then that began an investigation that took years and finally a hearing. And by the time the hearing and appeal concluded, our client had been engaged with the Title IX process throughout most of her college experience. So our office supported our client with each interview, the evidence reviews, and the many conversations with both the Title IX office and our team to prepare her for her hearing. So with our help, she ultimately prevailed at her Title IX hearing and obtained sanctions of a year suspension against the respondent. So our client struggled with the long delays and the Title IX process, which itself caused additional trauma and stress. And now she's advocating to draw attention to the impact of the long delays in the Title IX investigation. We're happy to support our clients with their goals of continuing to improve the school situation for other students.
Excellent, excellent. We've got enough time, I think, because I'm dying to ask you this question as well. I'm sitting here reflecting on the fact that, over 40 years ago, I was doing this work in Detroit, both individual and class action cases for discrimination. Many of our cases had to do with what was happening to women in the workplace, and I was hardly the first. So I guess my question is that we do have some others, but if you could perhaps give us a short answer on this one. Why do you think after all these years, and there have been great advances made, there's no doubt about it, but why is it still the case that there's still the pay gap, there's still assaults that were, we still have these problems. They're not rare. We're a long way from having them in the past, if you will. What do you think accounts for that, despite all the great work that your group and others have done and the general hopeful re-education of the American male and employers? We still have the problems you've been outlining for us and in great numbers. Why is that, do you think?
We're asked that in the past because people think that after the Me Too movement that the workplace has improved for a lot of people. I think part of it is that not all employers are familiar with the laws. Uh-huh. And so our work and that of our other project is just to make sure that employers have information about what the laws are and how to make sure their employees are following them. We also, from our perspective, want to support employees with assisting with engaging with employers about what the laws are. So that's a lot of our outreach with our Know Your Rights presentations and making sure people are aware of that. We would like to see the situation improve for so many people in the workplace. Most people just want to go to work, do their job, and get their paycheck at the end of the week and not have to worry about things that occur in the workplace.
Yes, absolutely, of course. Well, I know public counsel is also among the other great things that you do. It's very good about collaborating with other organizations and community groups, working on the same issue the particular staff member there is working on. Tell us about this coalition work and the kinds of solutions that you're sort of advancing together.
Well, I want to just mention that one of our project's solutions is to provide the direct, free, and low-cost services, and I know I'll talk about ways to access those, but I just want to make sure that people know they can reach out to us directly. And then we're also regularly monitoring litigation, and we try to weigh in on issues that impact gender and gender-expansive individuals in the workplace and higher education. So our direct services work informs the kind of solutions that we're advancing, including our legislative and policy work. So that is one of our solutions, and we found this to be particularly effective in collaborating with, for example, the California Work and Family Coalition. Mm-hmm. So one example is our clients are affected by limited sick leave. So we joined the California Work and Family Coalition, other organizations, in advocating for more paid sick leave. So the law changed on January 1st, and now all employers must provide 5 days or 40 hours of paid sick leave. And another solution that we're working on with our coalitions is to address family caregiver discrimination. So there's already protections for California workers, but currently the anti-discrimination law does not protect workers from being discriminated against specifically because they are family caregivers, parents, folks caring for family members with disabilities or the elderly. So California employees don't have protection if their employer treats them unfairly, for example, by denying them an opportunity or promotion And sometimes there's these unfounded assumptions that somebody's not going to be able to do that kind of job because they're a family caregiver. Hmm. So we're working with our coalition partners on legislation that would protect California workers from this kind of discrimination and address, for this example, for example, of an employer refusing to hire or promote their employee. And we also collaborate with community groups and legal aides in our work through CLEWA, the Coalition of Low-Wage Immigrant Worker Advocates. And through that coalition, one of the things we're working to do is problem solve around the administrative agency delays and improving the processes for workers who file complaints. We also do some work on Title IX. So we are part of several coalitions that include Equal Rights Advocates, Know Your Nine, and Advocates for Youth. So we are advocating for the implementation of the proposed Title IX regulations. And we're also fortunate to partner with legal aid organizations like Neighborhood Legal Services for presentations and outreach.
Well, good. Thank you for that. Yeah, I know we want to make sure we get to that last point. Maria, I know you're wondering about something, which I'm wondering about too. So get that out there too. Got to help some people. Yeah.
Well, I did want to, before we do close, we only have a couple minutes left, but I did want, and before you tell people how to get in touch with the Women and Girls Project or public counsel, it's the same thing. I did want you to highlight about the trauma-informed services that you provide, because I think one of the most difficult parts about speaking up, it's really scary. So they need to know, workers need to know that they have support. Can you talk about that? What is it like when somebody calls you or Neighborhood Legal Services, another legal aid? What sort of, what do they have to lose by calling and what do they have to gain?
So one of the things that we try to do with callers and potential clients is really talk about what their goals are, what they would like to see the outcome. And we can offer legal solutions, but also really thinking about the impact on a person, what kind of supports they might need in order to continue with their case, whether that means for some people accessing therapy before proceeding with their case or during the case. For other people, they may be seeking a change in a policy so that it doesn't affect other people. For some people, it might be to be made whole. So I think we spend a lot of time with our clients evaluating and assessing what their goals are and making sure that every step of the way they're being heard and giving them a chance to have a voice and be part of what they see as a solution to their legal situation.
Yes, thank you for that. And why don't you go ahead and give us, I knew it was going to go by fast, why don't you go ahead and give us the information, give listeners information about how they can contact either your project or, public counsel in general.
So our particular project has a weekly clinic on Wednesday nights from 4 to 7. So people can go to our website, which is www.publiccounsel.org/WGR, where they can also call for a clinic appointment, which is 213-386-3977, extension 410. We do not charge for our services, nor for this clinic call. So this is a way for people to talk to us and just see what their rights are. And then our website also contains information about our other projects of public counsel and how to access legal assistance. And we certainly would welcome people that would be interested in supporting our project, whether they're volunteers, attorneys, community members. Our volunteers help us with client meetings, our presentations, or with our litigation. So we welcome that help and support as well.
That's so great. And I know public counsel has also worked with the Lawyers Guild on various issues. So, yes, it's a great service. I can vouch for that. And I also wanted to give a shout out to Audrey Ermes, who funded the program. And I was also a beneficiary of her generosity from a fellowship out of law school.
Oh,
looking for
Wonderful.
So yeah, I'm a huge fan. But thank you so much.
Yes.
For my listeners, we have been speaking with Beth Graves Meyerhoff, attorney at Public Counsel, the Project for Women and Girls' Rights. So thank you so much for being with us on the Lawyers Guild show today, Beth.
Yeah, and thank you for your wonderful work. I knew something of the program, but frankly, not nearly as much as I know now. Thank you very much. And it is a remarkable program, not surprising because you are under the roof there of Public Counsel. But thank you personally for your great work in this area. And as Maria said, for joining us today. And I hope people out there who are having the kinds of problems that Beth has been talking about, don't be shy. You can do this. You can be protected. You're not going to lose your job necessarily just because you do this at all. In fact, they can't just retaliate against you. So please, if you have this problem and it's really making your life miserable or cheating you out of your just wages or whatever, we hope that you'll take to heart what Beth had to say today and give them a call and let's see if they can help you. All right. Well, I'll stop for a brief station ID and then we'll be right back with you. Right back with you, my friends.
Thank you.
Chimurenga. Join us at the Liberated Zone of Freedom Now every Saturday from 11 to noon for a Pan-African perspective on world affairs in a fly music mix. And as always, we stand ready for the revolution.
And as promised, we are right back with you. This is Jim Lafferty, along with Maria Hall, my co-host, and you're listening, of course, to the Lawyers Guild show, heard every week at this time. We join with others in thanking those of you that were generous enough to support this station, this free speech radio station, this community-based radio station, this radio station that brings you the guests and stories that you don't necessarily hear anywhere else, and brings you the truth about so many things that sometimes our government does not wish us to know. So we thank you for your support, and we urge those of you that haven't yet done so, you can still do so anytime. You can go to our website or give us a call and make a contribution. Well, now Maria and I are going to take up the thorny question that's related to the horrid war going on now between Israel and the Palestinians. Last month, more than 50 nations, more than 50 nations, presented testimony in the International Court of Justice, or the World Court as it's known, on the legality of Israel's decades-long occupation of Palestinian territory. Now, the overwhelming majority of them told the court that Israel's occupation is, in fact, illegal. And as our guest for this segment said in a recent article she wrote for truthout.org, it's entitled, Israel Didn't Even Try to Defend the Legality of Its Occupation to the World Court. Well, of course, this recent World Court case takes on added significance, given the current genocidal war Israel, with its arsenal of U.S.-provided weapons, is waging in Gaza and on the West Bank. So we wanted to cover this matter of Israel's occupation and how that occupation has been conducted by Israel since, for all too many of us, I think, in the United States, we don't necessarily have a deep understanding of this matter. And it's a hindrance, I suggest, for understanding fully the dire consequences of how that illegal occupation is relevant to what Israel is now doing militarily in occupied Palestine. So our guest is happily again Marjorie Cohn, who's on from time to time, who is an expert in such matters of international law. Indeed, Marjorie Cohn is professor of law emerita at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law and the former national president, I'm proud to say, of the National Lawyers Guild. She is dean of the People's Academy of International Law. She is on the board of Veterans for Peace and on the Bureau of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. Her books include Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. Marjorie Cohn is a regular contributor to truthout.org. And Marjorie Cohn, a warm, warm welcome back to the Lawyers Guild show.
Well, Well, thanks so much for having me, Jim and Maria.
Oh, no, it's a pleasure, really. Marjorie, last month's case concerning the legality of its occupation of Palestinian lands was heard to hear oral argument in connection with the United Nations General Assembly's request of a couple of years ago for an advisory opinion, is what they asked for, on a couple of questions that the General Assembly had wanted to know about. Now, what were those, I guess, two main questions? What were those questions? And who were the nations, by the way, some of the nations, by the way, that argued before the court?
Well, the first question to be answered was, what are the legal consequences arising from the ongoing violation by Israel of the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination from its prolonged occupation, settlement and annexation of the Palestinian territory occupied since 1967, including measures aimed at altering the demographic composition, character, and status of the Holy City of Jerusalem, and from its adoption of related discriminatory legislation and measures? That's the first question. The second question is, how do the policies and practices of Israel affect the legal status of the occupation, and what are the legal consequences that arise for all states and the United Nations from this status? Now, 50 member states of the United Nations and three international organizations presented oral statements during the six-day hearing before the World Court, and I will tell you who they were. Palestine, South Africa, Algeria, Saudi Arabia, the Netherlands, Bangladesh, Belgium, Belize, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Cuba, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, the United States, Russia, France, the Gambia, Guyana, Hungary, China, Iran, Iraq, Ireland, Japan, Jordan, Kuwait, Lebanon, Libya, Luxembourg, Malaysia, Mauritius, Namibia, Norway, Oman, Pakistan, Indonesia, Qatar, the UK, Slovenia, Sudan, Switzerland, Syria, Tunisia, Turkey, Zambia, Spain, Fiji, and the Maldives.
My goodness.
And the three organizations were the League of Arab States, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, and the African Union. And they all presented oral testimony.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah. Wow.
Well, Marjorie, as the title of your fine article informs, Israel did not appear before the court, did it? It wasn't one of those places that you listed. And indeed, you wrote that it did not even attempt to defend the legality of its occupation before the World Court, nor does it recognize the jurisdiction of the court. But while it didn't attend the presentation of oral testimony, it did it not, offer a short five-page written testimony to the court. Tell us about those 5 pages. What were they claiming?
Well, Maria, as Jim said in the introduction, Israel regularly thumbs its nose at the World Court. It ignored the court's ruling that the Israeli wall on Palestinian land was illegal, and Israel refuses to implement the World Court's provisional order to Israel to refrain from committing genocidal acts and ensure humanitarian aid to Israel. Now, before this hearing on the occupation, the six-day hearing, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu blasted the World Court. He said, Israel does not recognize the legitimacy of the proceedings of the International Court in The Hague regarding the, quote, legality of the occupation, unquote, which are an effort designed to infringe on Israel's right to defend itself against existential threats. The proceedings in The Hague are part of the Palestinian attempt to dictate the results of the diplomatic settlement without negotiations. And The Hague refers to the place in the Netherlands where the International Court of Justice sits. Now, as you said, Israel did file a 5-page statement. And in that statement, Israel called these two questions that the General Assembly wanted answered, and I did tell you what those questions were.
Yes.
All of those questions, a clear distortion of the history and present reality of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, unquote. Israel didn't even attempt to defend the legality of the occupation. It instead focused on why the World Court should not render an advisory opinion on this issue. And Israel complained that the World Court, quote, is asked simply to presume Israeli violations of international law, to accept as given plainly biased and flawed assertions directed against Israel alone, unquote. And I have to say, Maria, consent of the parties is not required for the World Court to render an advisory opinion. And nevertheless, Israel protested in its 5 pages that it had not, quote, given its consent to judicial settlement of its dispute with the Palestinian side, unquote. Israel thinks that this is not a matter for the World Court. This is rather a matter for negotiations. And, of course, Israel has stymied negotiations with the Palestinians for years. So it's really a disingenuous argument that Israel is making.
Mm-hmm. Well, Marjorie, your article points out that the overwhelming majority of the more than 50 nations and groups who appeared before the court argued that Israel's occupation of Palestine lands was and is illegal. What were some of the main arguments that were put forth by these nations? And in this regard, one reason, frankly, why we wanted to have you on to talk about this issue of the legality of the occupation was to give you a chance as well to talk about what for decades now Israel has done as the occupying power in terms of its treatment of the Palestinian people under its occupation. I mean, we hear from time to time about arbitrary arrests and without trials and shooting of kids throwing stones and such. But give us a broader picture of that, if you would, as of life under occupation as and how that figured into the arguments against the legality of Israel's occupation before the court.
Okay, well, just bear with me, Jim, and Maria, because this is going to take a little bit of time. It is considered a peremptory norm of international law, and that is called jus cogens. It means that it's the highest form of international law. It doesn't matter whether a country's ratified a treaty about it or not. There is no way that any country can ever pass legislation legalizing a peremptory norm, and there's no statute of limitations for it. So it's really the highest norm. So it's a peremptory norm of international law that territory cannot be acquired by force. In 1967, Israel launched a so-called preemptive war against Egypt, Jordan, and Syria, and seized the West Bank, Gaza, Jerusalem, the Golan Heights, and the Sinai Peninsula. And Israel has occupied those Palestinian territories ever since. Now, the representative of the U.S. State Department told the World Court that Israel was defending itself in the 1967 war. That's not true. It was Israel that initiated that war. In fact, Ireland's attorney general argued that the war Israel launched, talked about the war Israel launched, was an act of aggression. And Israel claimed to be acting in self-defense, anticipating a non-immediately imminent attack. But even assuming, arguendo, its claim of a feared attack, states cannot lawfully use force in non-immediately imminent anticipatory self-defense, unquote. And that's what they argued to the World Court. And they're absolutely correct, because Article 51 of the UN Charter forbids a state from using military force except in self-defense against an armed attack by another state. Moreover, in its opinion on Israel's barrier wall on Palestinian land, the World Court established the non-applicability of self-defense under Article 51 in the situation between Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory. The court held that an occupying power cannot claim self-defense when the threats emanate from inside the occupied territory. under the Geneva Conventions, an occupying power has a duty to protect the people under occupation, not to kill them. And Israel says, well, we haven't occupied the Gaza Strip since 2005 when we withdrew our military forces and settlement. However, Israel continues to exercise military control over Gaza through continuous military operations in and against Gaza. It exerts administrative control over Gaza through the exclusive regulation of all movement of goods and people, civil population registry, and its tax and revenue system. And Israel maintains continuous control over Gaza's borders, air and sea space, electricity, water, sewage, and telecommunication systems. So Gaza and its population remain under effective Israeli control and are therefore occupied. That's the test that the World Court laid down, effective control. So it is clear, according to the World Court and according to the Security Council in 2009 in Resolution 1860, that the Gaza Strip constitutes an integral part of the territory occupied in 1967. Now, I also should say that the Palestinians have the right to use force to resist Israel's illegal occupation. On several occasions, the General Assembly has reaffirmed, quote, the legitimacy of the struggle of peoples for independence, territorial integrity, national unity, and liberation from colonial domination, apartheid, and foreign occupation by all available means, including armed struggle, unquote. Now, the Netherlands told the World Court that self-determination is a permanent, continuing, universal, and inalienable right with a peremptory character. So once again, the right to self-determination is a peremptory norm of international law, the highest norm. If that right to self-determination is denied by Israel, Netherlands said, Palestinians living under colonial domination, apartheid, or foreign occupation have the right to liberate themselves by all available means, including armed struggle, in accordance with international law. Now, regarding the conditions you asked about, Jim, under this occupation, the foreign minister of Palestine, Riyad al-Maliki, argued eloquently before the World Court, and he said that the genocide underway in Gaza is the result of decades of impunity and inaction. Ending Israel's impunity is a moral, political, and legal imperative. And he said successive Israeli governments have given the Palestinian people only three options: displacement, subjugation, or death. These are the choices: ethnic cleansing, apartheid, or genocide. He told the court, Israel restricts every aspect of Palestinian life from birth to death, resulting in manifest human rights violations and an overt system of repression and persecution. Through indiscriminate killing, summary execution, mass arbitrary arrest, torture, forced displacement, settler violence, movement restrictions, and blockades, Israel subjects Palestinians to inhumane life conditions and untold human indignities, affecting the fate of every man, woman, and child under its control. And the ambassador from Belize made a very powerful statement to the World Court, which was echoed by many of the other countries. And he said, no state reserves to itself the right to systematically violate the rights of a people to self-determination, except Israel. Mm. No state seeks to justify the indefinite occupation of another's territory, except Israel. No state commits annexation and apartheid with impunity, except, it seems, Israel. And he said that Israel must not be allowed such blatant impunity. He said Israel must be made to behave like all civilized nations, stop violating international law and UN resolutions, respect the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination. Palestine must be free. Now, Israel also, Jim, maintains a system of apartheid in the occupied Palestinian territory, which has been confirmed by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem.
Indeed.
South Africa's ambassador to the Netherlands told the World Court that, and this is really stunning, that Israel's apartheid system is, quote, an even more extreme form of the apartheid that was institutionalized against black people in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Now, turning to the West Bank, what are the conditions there? Israel preserves its separation wall, segregated roads, checkpoints, and restrictive permit requirements. And while Israelis are subject to a civil legal system, Palestinians are under the control of a military system. They can be held indefinitely with no charges, no due process, in what's called administrative detention, and can be convicted based on secret evidence. So the legal counsel for the African Union, who was a member of the Palestine delegation, told the World Court, using a toolbox of population control and inhumane acts amounting to aggravated forms of racial discrimination, Israel restricts every aspect of Palestinian life from birth to death, resulting in manifest human rights violations and an overt system of repression and persecution. Mm-hmm. And then I just want to say briefly, just to sum up this this answer, that Israeli settlements on Palestinian land constitute illegal annexation. More than 700,000 Israeli settlers, which is 10% of the nearly 7 million people in Israel, have been transferred into the occupied Palestinian territories, continuously terrorizing and forcibly displacing Palestinians from even more of their territory and engaging in pogroms against them. And that was a statement by Belize.
Oof.
And also, the settlements violate the Geneva Convention, which says the occupying power shall not deport or transfer parts of its own civilian population into the territory it occupies.
Wow. Okay.
Well, Marjorie Cohen, you briefly mentioned the United States. So can you talk a little bit more about what the U.S. argued in defense of Israel on the matter of legality of its occupation of Palestine?
Right. Well, I just want to preface it by saying, Maria, that a handful of countries, including the U.S., Canada, the U.K., Fiji, Hungary, Italy, and Zambia, sided with Israel. Only Fiji argued that the occupation was lawful. The U.S. contended that an occupation can be neither lawful nor unlawful. It's rather governed exclusively by international humanitarian law, which deals only with acts by the occupying power and doesn't examine the legality of the occupation itself. And Richard Vysick from the U.S. State Department told the court that, quote, the court should not find that Israel is legally obligated to immediately and unconditionally withdraw from occupied territory. He urged the court to consider Israel's, quote, legitimate security needs, unquote. And Vysick defended Israel in the World Court the day after the U.S. vetoed a Security Council resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza for the fourth time. And as you know, the U.S. provides military, political, and diplomatic cover to Israel, without which it could not pursue its genocide or occupation of the Palestinian people.
Mm-hmm. My goodness, I'm just listening to that. Maria and I both are lawyers, here the United States making that shabby argument is it's not as dangerous as what it's doing every day with its 2,000-pound bombs that it gives Israel, but by God, what an argument, or not. Anyway, we do have a few minutes left, and Israel, you know, never, you know, follows what the World Court tells it to do. So I guess the question is, and any other last thoughts you might have, how does this matter? I mean, since Israel will continue to do whatever the hell it wants to do, apparently, and won't be governed, if history is any example here, by what the court says, why does it matter? And any other last thoughts you have?
That's a good question, Jim. The International Court of Justice, the World Court, is the highest court in the world. It's an independent court. It has judges from many different countries. It's a nonpartisan court. And when the World Court makes a decision and says for example, the occupation by Israel of Palestinian territory is illegal, that carries a tremendous amount of weight, and that will fuel the global movement against Israel's genocide and Israel's occupation.
Mm-hmm.
It will enhance the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which is really having an impact on Israel, so much so that Netanyahu a few years ago came to the United States and called it an existential threat to Israel. And also, the General Assembly may well meet and order sanctions, an arms embargo, encouraging or mandating that countries in the General Assembly, General Assembly, by the way, is the democratic body of the UN, all 193 countries have one vote, as opposed to the elite Security Council, where the U.S. continually vetoes
these resolutions
to criticize Israel. And also, there's one other thing. And this is something that we aren't used to. We're used to you violate a law, you go to jail. But this is called, it's a concept that's called the mobilization of shame. The mobilization of shame. And it is a concept that means that if and when the world court declares that Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory is illegal, that will result in the mobilization of shame against Israel in the eyes of the world. And that's very significant. In fact, we see Joe Biden on the ropes because
he loses
a lot of votes because of his complicity in the genocide. And there's pressure on him. I don't know that he'll do anything significant.
Yeah, well.
No U.S. president ever says peep. When Israel says jump, they say how high. And nothing is too much money for Israel, according to the U.S. government. But it's having a real impact when people see those photographs of Israel's genocide and hear that over 30,000 people, now 31,000 Palestinians, have been slaughtered in Gaza. That, together with a ruling from the World Court, the highest court in the world, saying that Israel's occupation is illegal, will fuel the movement against Israel. Millions of people have been in the streets.
Yes.
Genocide and the boycott, divestment, and sanctions.
Yes.
Movement.
Marjorie, I'm interrupting you simply because we basically are out of time, and I want to give you a chance to remind our listeners where they can follow your writings. Let me tell you, I follow her writings very diligently. They're brilliant. You don't need to be a lawyer from Harvard or Yale or someplace to understand them. They're in plain English. They're beautifully written. So tell us about how our listeners can learn more about this by following your writings.
Well, thanks so much for that, those kind words, Jim. I write a regular column for Truthout. You go to truthout.org and go to the bottom under Human Rights and Global Wrongs, and you'll see all my articles. And then they're collected on my website, along with interviews, books, videos, etc., marjoriecohn.com.
Wonderful. It is what I encourage you folks to go to that. This is a critical issue. It's going to be with us for quite some time, I'm afraid. And we all need to owe it to ourselves and to know what's really going on and what the basis for it all is. So thank you, Marjorie Cohn, for joining us again here on the Lawyers Guild Show. Thanks to all our listeners for listening to us today. We always appreciate that. Keep supporting the station. Stay well, stay active, join us again next week, and until then, make sure you keep standing up for those rights, my friends.
Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Not only are KPFK listeners smart, interesting, and forward-thinking, you're also very generous and deeply appreciated. Thank you so much for pledging your support to KPFK during our fund drive.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Ashley Judd, and I believe that when we listen collectively, change happens. And I believe we should listen to girls and women. I believe that girls and women should speak for themselves, with and for each other, about their bodies, their rights, and their dreams. That's why I think woman-made media is so important, and why we all need to tune in to Feminist Magazine on KPFK.
Support comes from